This is Lesson 4 of Isaiah Part 1. Our focus today will be on chapters 7 and 8 and the first 7 verses of chapter 9. Let's begin with a quick review of the first 6 chapters. Chapter 1 sets out the fact that Israel had turned away from God and abandoned Him. Because of sin, they were rebellious sons who despised their father. This chapter 1 is really a microcosm of the whole book because it sets out an outline of sin and the gracious offer of redemption and healing. We saw that chapter 2 was divided into segments. The beginning of the chapter described Jerusalem raised up in the future as the chief of the mountains, and the nations will go up to Jerusalem to learn the ways of the Lord. The next segment of chapter 2 explains and justifies God's abandonment of Israel, but the largest segment, verses 10 through 22, parallel Revelation chapter 6, verses 12 through 17, as they describe the onset of the day of the Lord, in which the Lord alone will be exalted, and everyone who is proud and lofty will be abased. In chapter 3, because the people of Judah relied on the arm of flesh rather than on the Lord for their protection and support, the Lord announces that He is going to remove from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, beginning with their leadership. He will arise to contend with and to judge the people. The last segment of this chapter, which begins at verse 16 and really ends with verse 1 of chapter 4, describes how the Lord will afflict the daughters of Zion. Chapter 4 is a short chapter of only 6 verses, which is really reduced to 5 since verse 1 belongs with the last part of chapter 3. These 5 verses of chapter 4 describe a future time when the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the cleansed survivors, the remnant of Israel, will be called holy. Although there were 2 woes in chapter 3, there are 6 woes in chapter 5. Woe to the unproductive vineyard which the Lord has planted and cared for, but which produced only worthless grapes. For that reason, the Lord would send them into exile with a strong foreign nation. Chapter 6, which records the commissioning of Isaiah, occurred in the year of King Uzziah's death. According to the timeline, this was in the year 739 BC. We already know that because of Uzziah's leprosy, his son Jotham had been his co-regent for the last 10 years of his life. This same timeline shows the reign of Jotham from 750 BC to 731 BC. Now that's a period of 19 years, although sometimes the year that a king ascended to the throne was not counted as his first year. If that is the case, then it is really a period of 18 years that Jotham was on the throne. Frankly, I am not sure why this timeline we are given in the book shows these dates, because 2 Kings chapter 15 verse 33 and 2 Chronicles chapter 27 verses 1 and 8 all say that Jotham reigned for 16 years. Moreover, this timeline shows a 4-year overlap in the reigns of Jotham and his son Ahaz, but we are not given the explanation for that overlap in either 2 Kings or in 2 Chronicles. All we are told is that when Jotham died, his son Ahaz became king in his place. The timing of chapter 7 is at the beginning of the reign of Ahaz. According to the timeline that is provided in the book, this is 4 years after the death of Uzziah and the commissioning of Isaiah. If, however, the reign of Ahaz did not begin until the death of Jotham in 731 BC, then there's a gap of 8 years from the time of Isaiah's commissioning until the first time that he begins to speak. The Bible does not record any prophetic activity of Isaiah during the reign of Jotham. Despite the fact that both Uzziah and Jotham were characterized as good kings, we are told that the people continued to act corruptly. This is consistent with Isaiah's description of the condition of the people in chapters 1 through 5 of the book of Isaiah. Because of the unrepentant rebellion of the people against the Lord, 2 Kings chapter 15 verse 37 says, "In those days the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah." Then the very next verse, verse 18 says, "And Jotham slept with his fathers, and he was buried with his fathers in the city of David his father, and Ahaz his son became king in his place." The important fact to notice here is that despite the reign of two good kings, the Lord was beginning to move in judgment against his people. While Jotham was still alive, the text says that the Lord began to send the Arameans and the Israelites against Judah. We will return to them, the Israelites and the Arameans, in just a moment. First, let's look at Jotham's son, Ahaz. Unlike his father and grandfather, Ahaz did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord. 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 3 and 4 say that, quote, "He walked in the way of the kings of Israel," which we know means that it's a bad way because all the kings of the north were bad kings. Returning to verse 3. "And he even made his son pass through the fire according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had driven out from before the sons of Israel." Verse 4. "And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree." The next verse of 2 Kings chapter 16 corresponds with Isaiah chapter 7 verse 1, which says, "Now it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it." 2 Kings chapter 16 verse 5 says the same thing. This appears to be a summary statement, however, and then, at least in 2 Kings 16, although not in Isaiah chapter 7, we are given the full story. The Arameans and the Israelites could not conquer Judah, but they still managed to inflict serious damage. The context of this odd alliance between the northern kingdom Israel and the Arameans is that the Assyrians had become a growing and expanding menace to all the kingdoms in the Middle East. Israel and Aram had allied themselves, and they were attempting to convince other nations to join their alliance against Assyria. We don't know the details of their negotiations with Judah because they're not given. If there were any negotiations, however, they were unsuccessful, because Isaiah chapter 7 verses 5 and 6 set out exactly what Aram and Israel intended to do. Verse 5, "Because Aram with Ephraim," which is another word for Israel, "and the son of Remaliah," which is Pekah, the king of Israel, "has planned evil against you, saying, 'Let us go up against Judah and terrorize it, and make for ourselves a breach in its walls, and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it.'" So what they were intending to do was to get rid of King Ahaz and set up a puppet king of their choice, one whom they could control, who was the son of Tabeel. The Lord had such a low opinion of this man that he would not even give the man's name, but only the father's name, Tabeel. And that name means good for nothing. During this time, 2 Kings chapter 16, verse 6 tells us that, quote, "At that time, Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Elath for Aram and cleared the Judeans out of Elath entirely, and the Arameans came to Elath and have lived there to this day." This is in the southern part of Judah, and the Arameans are well north of it. So that means they came around to the south, and they cleared out the Judeans out of there and occupied that city. It is difficult to set out the chronology as it is recorded in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, 2 Kings chapter 16, and Isaiah chapter 7. My best guess is that Isaiah did not go to speak to Ahaz until after the events of 2 Chronicles chapter 28 verses 5 through 15. In that passage in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, it establishes that the Lord did deliver Judah into the hands of the Arameans and the Israelites. In one day, 20,000 men of Judah were slain. The Arameans and the Israelites took many of the women and children captive. The Arameans took their captives all the way north to Damascus, and the Israelites were in the process of taking their 200,000 women and children to Samaria, where they were met by a prophet whose name was Oded. He told them that the Lord had delivered the men of Judah into the hands of the Israelites because of their sins against the Lord. Did not they, the men of Israel, also have sins of their own against the Lord? He warned them to return the captives because the anger of the Lord burned against them. The men of Israel heeded the warning and returned the captives. In the meantime, in addition to the attacks from the Arameans and the Israelites, Judah was also subject to attacks from the Edomites and the Philistines. The Lord had completely removed their hedge of protection and was allowing all of Judah's surrounding neighbors to attack. At this point, the narrative in 2 Chronicles chapter 28 parallels that of 2 Kings chapter 16. King Ahaz decided to appeal to Assyria for help. It is my opinion that before King Ahaz appealed to Assyria for help, Isaiah went to give him the message from the Lord. Let's return to Isaiah chapter 7. Verse 2 says, "When it was reported to the house of David," meaning King Ahaz, "saying, 'The Arameans have camped in Ephraim,'" which is another name for Israel, "his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind." Verse 3 continues, "Then the Lord said to Isaiah, 'Go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son, Shear-Jashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, take care and be calm. Have no fear and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands, on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah." Both the people of Judah and their king were shaking in their boots from fear of the Israelites and the Arameans. But to the Lord, they were nothing more than two stubs of smoldering firebrands. In an attempt to diminish the fear of Ahaz, Isaiah characterized Aram and Israel not as blazing torches, but as burned out, smoking stubs or remains of the torches, because in God's economy, they already were. In Isaiah chapter 7, verse 8, the Lord tells Ahaz through Isaiah that within another 65 years, Israel, here called Ephraim, would no longer even be a people. To further demonstrate his contempt, the Lord even called the king of Israel the son of Remaliah, instead of calling him by his own name, Pekah. At the end of verse 9, the Lord, speaking through Isaiah, warned King Ahaz, "If you will not believe, you surely shall not last." This warning is particularly important, so I thought it would be interesting to look at it in its various translations. In this particular instance, I like the NIV translation best. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. We've already seen the NASB. If you will not believe, you surely shall not last. The ESV, the English Standard Version, says, if you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. And the King James Version says, if ye will not believe, surely ye shall not be established. A New Testament way of saying the same thing is in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, which says, without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. In other words, Isaiah was telling the king to put his trust for deliverance in the Lord alone and not in the arm of man. The warning was that if the king chose to put his trust in alliances with the nations of the world, he would incur the judgment of the Lord. After all, through Isaiah, the Lord had already told Ahaz in verses 5 and 6 what the plans of the Arameans and the Israelites were, and he had already assured the king in verse 7 that their plans would not succeed. When he said in verses 8 and 9 that Rezin was the head of Aram and that the son of Remaliah was the head of Israel or Ephraim, what was implied but not explicitly said was, and who is the head of Judah? If it is the Lord himself, then what have you to fear from them or from any man? In a further effort to encourage Ahaz to put his trust wholeheartedly in the Lord invited Ahaz to ask for a supernatural sign as a pledge that the Lord's words would be fulfilled. In other words, that Judah would continue to stand because the plot of Israel and Aram would fail. But Ahaz refused, piously saying that he would not test the Lord. We know that this apparent piety is hypocritical because verse 13 indicates that he has now tried the patience of God. While it is true, as a general rule, that believers are not to test the Lord, that is because when we test the Lord, it generally stems from unbelief. People put God to the test when they will not believe his word. The problem here was that Ahaz had apparently already decided to seek help from the Assyrians against the Arameans and the Israelites. His thinking might have gone along these lines. Let Israel ally themselves with Syria, Aram. Once I have Assyria on my side, I, Judah, will be greater and more powerful than Israel. Ahaz wanted no miraculous sign to cause him to renounce his own plans and to believe in the power of God. Like most of the people that Isaiah had described in chapters 1 through 5, Ahaz would not believe in the Lord God without seeing. But when a sign was offered so that he might see and believe, he would not even look. His problem was that if he did ask for a sign, and if the Lord gave him a sign, he would be held accountable to obey the instruction to place his wholehearted trust in the Lord and not in the other nations of the world. And he had already hardened his heart and made his decision where he would place his trust. Undeterred by Ahaz's refusal to ask for a sign, the Lord gave one anyway. It was what is to us the familiar prophecy of the virgin birth. Isaiah chapter 7 verse 14. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. Actually, the first prophecy of the virgin birth was given in Genesis chapter 3 verse 15 when the Lord told Eve that her seed, singular, would bruise the serpent, meaning the devil, on his head. Since women have eggs, but not seeds, and since the seed is singular, this is a reference to a virgin birth. The name Emmanuel means God with us. Thus, this sign that the Lord gave through Isaiah was a prophecy that the Messiah would be divine as well as born of a virgin. In Isaiah chapter 6, when Isaiah was commissioned, the Lord told him that his message would be rejected by the majority of those who heard it, and in fact, the message would serve to further harden their already hard hearts. In chapter 7, we see the first example of this happening in King Ahaz. Verses 15 and 16 of chapter 7 may be another prophecy with both near and far fulfillment. These verses say, "The boy will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken." Since Jesus Christ was not born for more than 700 years after Isaiah spoke these words, it is clear that these verses must also refer to a boy born in the near future relative to Ahaz. Nevertheless, the near fulfillment could be only partial, since it could not be a virgin birth. Verse 16 speaks of the land belonging to the two kings that he dreaded being forsaken. These two kings were, of course, the kings of Aram and Israel. The remaining verses describe the devastation of the land of Judah, which the Lord would bring upon them in judgment. Twice so far in chapter 7, the Lord has declared that the kings of Aram and Israel will not be a threat to Judah. The first time was in verses 4 through 7, and the second time is here in verse 16, when the Lord tells Ahaz that the land of those two kings will be forsaken. Apparently, however, Ahaz still did not believe it. And so, after providing the sign that Ahaz refused to ask for, the Lord pronounced judgment on Judah. Verse 20 says that the Lord would shave Judah with a razor, and the barber would be the king of Assyria. There was a cross-reference in 2 Samuel chapter 10, verses 4 and 5, to explain to us that it was humiliating to a man to have his hair shaved off. The references to curds and honey indicate that there would be nothing else to eat because of the devastation and the destruction caused by the Assyrians. But there would be so few people left, one cow and a pair of sheep would provide enough for everyone. And all this would happen at the time that the boy knew enough to refuse evil and choose good. In other words, it would not be long before Assyria came against Judah. And not just Assyria, but Egypt also. The nation of Egypt would swarm upon the land like flies and cause destruction. The nation of Assyria would be more organized, more like bees than flies, but they would be so numerous that the Assyrian warriors could be found on steep ravines, on the ledges of cliffs, on all the thorn bushes, and on all the watering places. And this, I think, brings us in the chronology back to 2 Chronicles chapter 28, beginning at verse 16, and to 2 Kings chapter 16, beginning at verse 7. In the face of God's word to him through Isaiah, Ahaz sought help from the king of Assyria. In an attempt to buy his favor, Ahaz took the silver and the gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, and he sent a present to the king of Assyria. All these treasures did not buy very much, however. 2 Kings chapter 16, verse 8 indicates that the king of Assyria did help Ahaz by capturing Damascus and killing the Aramean king, Rezin. But I get the impression that Assyria was planning to do that anyway, and not as a favor to Ahaz, because we are told that the king of Assyria then afflicted Ahaz instead of strengthening him. At this point, Ahaz became even more unfaithful to the Lord. He closed the doors of the temple, moved the bronze altar from the temple for his own personal use, cut up the utensils of the temple in pieces, and in general provoked the Lord God to great anger. For a title for chapter 7, I first wrote a paraphrase of the key verse for this chapter, which is the latter part of verse 9. If you will not believe, you will not last. But then I broke the chapter down into three segments. Verses 1 through 9 contain the message of the Lord regarding Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the king of Israel. Verses 10 through 14 are about the sign of the virgin birth. And verses 15 through 25 discuss the Lord's imminent judgment of Judah using the instruments of Egypt and Assyria. In terms of the entire book of Isaiah, chapter 7 begins a new segment. The first segment is made up of the first five chapters, which set out the condition of God's people. The king of Judah during those five chapters was Uzziah. Chapter 6, the commissioning of Isaiah, occurred during the reign of Jotham. That's the second segment. This third segment is under the reign of Ahaz, and the primary subject is God's judgment. Nevertheless, chapters 7 through 12 are also called the Book of Emmanuel because of the messianic prophecies in these chapters. It may seem to you that these two subjects are opposites, and so they are. The message of God's judgment was addressed to the majority of the people who were in unrepentant rebellion against God. The promise of the prophecy of Emmanuel was for Isaiah and his followers. It was to this band of righteous people that the promise of chapter 3, verse 10, was also addressed. This verse 10 says, "Say to the righteous that it will go well with them, for they will eat the fruit of their actions." Chapter 8 begins with an instruction of the Lord to write an enigmatic message on a large tablet. While the message itself may be familiar to most of us, its meaning may be as elusive as it was to the original recipients in Isaiah's day. The message was, "Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey." Here's what the message meant. The blade of judgment will fall swiftly, and nothing will stop it. Like the end of chapter 7, this chapter is about Assyria coming against Judah. The Lord's message was so important that he named two witnesses. Knowing that the people would not understand the enigmatic message, the Lord was simply making a public record to document the fact that he himself was foretelling the course of events that were about to occur. In the meantime, the Lord would provide a living message in the sign of the name of Isaiah's second son. The long name of this boy, which is in verse 3 of chapter 8, was Maher Shalal Tash Baz. This would be a good time to bring in the name of the elder son as well as Isaiah's name. We saw in the introduction that the name Isaiah means the salvation of Jehovah. The elder son was named Shear Jashub, which means a remnant shall return. There was great hope in this name because it signified that after the people of Judah had been taken away into captivity in Babylon for 70 years, a remnant would return to the land of Israel. Of course, from our perspective, the name has additional meaning because we know that at the end of Daniel's 70th week, the remnant of one-tenth of the Jews will return to the land of Israel for the millennial kingdom. The second son's name, Maher Shalal Kash Baz, was the same as the enigmatic message that Isaiah was directed to write on a large tablet. It means, swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. Amplifying this a little bit, it means, swiftly comes the enemy to the spoils, or the booty. Speedily the enemy comes to the prey. Thus, this second son, like the tablet, was a symbol of the approaching judgment of both Syria, Aram, and the northern kingdom. Verse 4 explains that before the boy would know how to say mama or daddy, the Assyrians would conquer Damascus, the capital of Aram, and would carry away the spoil of Samaria, which is the capital of the northern kingdom, Israel. This boy's name would have been no source of comfort for the believing followers of Isaiah. Even when the Assyrians were finished with Aram and the northern kingdom of Israel, that would be when the real problems in Judah would begin. And so the passage that begins in chapter 8, verse 5, and continues through chapter 9, verse 7, is primarily a message of consolation to those righteous people who would have to live through the coming dark times. It was the promise of Emmanuel. Chapter 8, verse 5 says, "Again the Lord spoke to me further, saying." This word from the Lord extends all the way through chapter 12. But because it is a message of consolation, this presupposes the need for consolation. Thus it begins with the Lord's message of judgment of the majority of the people in Israel and Judah. Verse 6 begins, "Inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah." The pool of Siloam was located on the southeastern side of the old city. It was a natural spring or brook, and here, in this context, it represents the Davidic monarchy under the rule and the authority of God. This is contrasted with the strong and abundant and overflowing waters of the Euphrates in verse 7, which represent the world power of Assyria. Verse 6 explains that the people had rejected the authority of God. This is consistent with chapter 1, verse 4, which states that the people of God had abandoned him, despised him, and turned away from him. The overflowing of the waters, which represented the growing menace of Assyria, would sweep over the northern kingdom first. Those who are described in chapter 8, verse 6, as people who rejoiced in Rezin, the king of Aram, and in the king of Israel, who is again described in the pejorative way as the son of Remaliah, instead of by his own name, Pekah. Later, Assyria would sweep on into Judah, reaching even up to the neck, according to verse 8. Although it may not seem like it, there is mercy even in this description, because the waters, though they come up to the neck, do not go over the head. This is a prophecy of the Assyrians coming against Judah after they, meaning the Assyrians, had conquered the northern kingdom of Israel. This would happen in the days of the next king, Hezekiah. But because Hezekiah turned to the Lord, the Assyrians would be turned back. Verses 9 and 10 are addressed to the nations of the world. Verse 9 says, "Give ear, all remote places of the earth." What the Lord was saying to those nations was that they might devise plans against Judah, but they would be thwarted because God was with Judah. In verses 11 through 15, the Lord told Isaiah not to walk in the way of the people of Judah. They were saying that there was a conspiracy, which was probably a reference to the alliance between Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the king of Israel. But in verse 12, the Lord instructs Isaiah not to fear what the people feared, which was the threat of other nations. Instead, Israel and all people should regard the Lord of hosts as holy, and only he should be feared. You may recall that in chapter 2, verse 22, the Lord warned the people of Judah not to put their trust in man. That verse 22 says, "Stop regarding man, whose breath of life is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed?" And then, returning to chapter 8, verse 14 points out that, "When it is the Lord of hosts whom you regard as holy, then he shall become a sanctuary." In contrast, to those in both Judah and Israel who were relying on alliances with other countries to avoid being conquered by Assyria, the Lord would become a rock to stumble over, a snare, and a trap. Cross-references in the New Testament to these verses included 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. "For those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word." Returning to Isaiah chapter 8, verses 16 through 22 contrast the different responses of believers and unbelievers to the judgment of the Lord. In verse 16, Isaiah writes, "Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples." The testimony probably refers to the word of the Lord that was given at the beginning of the chapter and witnessed by the two men of verse 2. This conclusion is based on the text of verse 18, in which Isaiah says that he and the children whom the Lord gave him were for signs to Israel from the Lord of hosts. In particular, this would refer to Isaiah's second son, whose name was "Swift as the booty, speedy as the prey." Since the majority of the people of Israel would not listen to or understand the message of this son's name, the testimony was to be bound up and sealed among Isaiah's disciples, those who had believed the word of the Lord. Isaiah and his followers would wait eagerly for the Lord, in contrast to the majority in Israel, including their king, Ahaz. In fact, instead of turning to the Lord, the majority in Israel would consult mediums and spiritists to tell them what the future held. And they would do this despite the fact that the Lord, through Isaiah, had just written on a tablet that he was sending judgment swiftly. Of course, even if they paid attention to what Isaiah was writing, they still did not understand. But Isaiah pointed out that anyone who did not speak according to the word of the Lord had no light. And when God's judgment would come, those people who had turned away from the Lord and rejected him would pass through the land hard pressed and famished, and they would curse both their king and God. Because they only looked for solutions within the world system, they would find only distress and darkness, and the Lord would drive them away into darkness. But the darkness mentioned twice in the last verse of chapter 8 is broken in the opening verses of chapter 9. Before we turn to chapter 9, let's get a title for chapter 8. Judgment is swiftly coming. The contrasting responses of Isaiah and those of Judah, led by Ahaz. Turning now to Isaiah chapter 9, the first thing I discovered was that in the various translations of verse 1, the King James translation is quite different from the NASB, the ESV, and the NIV. All begin the same way, indicating that the darkness of Israel's distress that existed in Isaiah's time would not remain. The next part of the verse indicates that in earlier times, the Lord afflicted or humbled or brought into contempt the land that was allocated to the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali. But the next part is where the variance occurs. The NASB, ESV, and NIV indicate that in the latter times, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The King James translation, however, says the opposite. And afterward did more grievously afflict her by the way of the sea beyond Jordan in Galilee of the nations. I checked the Hebrew in an interlinear Bible and learned that the Hebrew word is kabad, which means to be heavy in either a good sense or in a bad sense. Thus, it can mean to afflict or to glorify. Given the context, I think the correct meaning is to honor or to glorify. This verse is saying that the very areas which God subjected to great humiliation at the hands of the Assyrians, God would in the future honor. The lands that he is describing, the lands of Naphtali and Zebulun, were the upper and lower Galilee. The road by the sea, or the way by the sea, was the land on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. On the other side of Jordan was the land to the east of the Jordan. And the Galilee of the Gentiles was the northernmost border of Galilee, constantly exposed to corruption from Gentile influence and to skirmishes and wars between Israel, the northern kingdom, and the Arameans, the Syrians. These would be the lands that would be honored when the morning dawn of glory should break. Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 through 17 say, Jesus settled in Capernaum, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. Then verse 13 of Matthew 4 specifically says that this was to fulfill what was written through Isaiah the prophet. And then Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 from the latter part and 2 are then quoted. Returning to Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2 is a familiar one. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. These first two verses of chapter 9 seem to be describing the first coming of Christ. The land of Israel, both northern and southern kingdoms, would be in complete apostasy, in total darkness, for centuries before the birth of Christ. Verses 3 through 5, in contrast, appear to describe his second coming. The first two sentences of verse 3 say, "You shall multiply the nation, and you shall increase their gladness." Multiplication and increase go hand in hand. The nation that is referred to here will be the remnant of Israel that will possess the land in the millennial kingdom and thereafter. Although they will be just a remnant, perhaps only one-tenth of the number that went into the Great Tribulation, the Lord will multiply their numbers and increase their joy. It will be a holy joy, because the next part of verse 3 says that their joy will be in His presence. And then the joy is further described in two ways. The first is, as with the gladness of harvest. This is the joy over blessings received. The second is, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. This is the joy that the conqueror experiences when evil has been defeated. Verse 4 compares the deliverance of this remnant with the deliverance of the entire nation from Egypt. The reason that the battle of Midian, which is described in Judges chapter 7, is referred to is that before that battle, the Lord had Gideon pare down his army from 32,000 men to 300. Because ultimately the battle and the victory belonged to the Lord, the battle was won with approximately one-tenth of the original army. Verse 5 then describes the destruction of the military gear of the conquered foe after victory has been won. So here's the progression of verses 3 through 5. There is great joy and gladness, which results from their deliverance, which results from the destruction of the enemy. And finally, when we get to verse 6 of Isaiah chapter 9, Isaiah moves to the description of the person who has effected this deliverance. This is the same person whom Isaiah foretold in chapter 7, verse 14. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. The difference is that here in chapter 9, Emmanuel is fully grown and has taken possession of the government. In chapter 7, it is the mother who names the child. But here in chapter 9, the child is given to us. And he is all those wonderful names for us. The first two names are sometimes considered one. The New American Standard, the English Standard Version, and the New International Version have translated it Wonderful Counselor. But some say that each is a name unto itself. The King James and the New King James translations favor this position because there's a comma between Wonderful and Counselor. The next name given is Mighty God. Isaiah was told plainly that the Messiah would be divine. And what is divine must be eternal, as the next name assures us, Eternal Father. As a counselor and as a father, the Messiah is the perfect guardian and provider for his people throughout eternity. He is also the prince who embodies peace in his rule over the nations. Although this promise of an eternal kingdom ruled by the Prince of Peace was future not only from Isaiah's time, but also still from our perspective, the promise is guaranteed by the last sentence in verse 7, which says, "The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this." The Hebrew word for zeal is kinah, and it is usually translated as envy or jealousy. According to the Kyle and Delitzsch, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that properly, we'll call it K and D, commentary on the Old Testament, the Hebrew word literally means glowing fire, and it derives from an Arabic word that means to be deep red. The zeal of the Lord is two-sided. Just as we saw last week regarding fire and the two-edged sword and the word of God, they either purify or they destroy. The two sides of the zeal of the Lord of hosts are the fire of love and the fire of wrath. Let me quote from KND's commentary, quote, "Jealousy contends for the object of its love against everything that touches either the object or the love itself. But this includes not only jealousy seeking the recovery of what it has lost, but also jealousy that consumes what cannot be saved." The zeal of the Lord, this righteous jealousy with which he guards those who are his, is something that we need to consider very seriously. Let's go back and pick up some verses we have looked at before. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 8 says, "Their land has also been filled with idols. They worship the work of their hands, that which their fingers have made." In addition, the last verse of that chapter 2 and the first verse of chapter 3 warn Judah not to rely upon the strength of man, but to fear God, who actually has the power to provide or to remove provision. Chapter 2, verse 22 says, "Stop regarding man." Then verse 3, verse 1 says, "For behold, the Lord God of hosts is going to remove both supply and support." Since the character of fallen man has not changed, we need to be examining ourselves to see whether we are relying upon idols that we have made for ourselves, whether we are relying upon alliances with other men, instead of relying completely upon the supply and the support of the Lord God of hosts. Recently, I read a book about idolatry that ties right in with our consideration of the zeal, the holy jealousy of the Lord. I'm going to conclude our lesson today with notes I made on that book about idolatry in the world today. The book is called Gods at War, and the author is Kyle Eidelman. This book begins with an examination of the first commandment and the second commandment, and then it explains how our breaking of the rest of the commandments comes out of our misunderstanding of the meaning and intent, and therefore our breaking of the first two. The first commandment says, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. The second commandment is, you shall not make for yourself an idol, or any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Now let's return to the first commandment. You shall not have any gods before me. God is not saying, you can have as many gods as you want, as long as you put me first. A more accurate translation from the Hebrew is, you shall not have any gods in my presence. What this means is, he will not even be the first among many gods. He will not tolerate any underling gods. He will not be the CEO of the universe with a board of directors, meaning other gods, below him. Every director on that board must be fired and removed from the room so that God alone rules in your life. Who are those directors on the board that must be removed? The answer comes from the second commandment, which says that you shall not make for yourself any idol. Now we think of the plethora of idols that the Egyptians worshipped and that the Canaanites worshipped, and we think that's what God was talking about. Well, in that context, he was. But his words are timeless, remember, and we are no different from the Israelites. Like all human beings, we were created to worship. We are hardwired to worship. It's in our DNA. Kyle Eidelman addresses the definition of worship on page 59 of his book. Let me quote him directly. When someone says, I'm not the religious type, he or she is missing the point. If that person is a member of the human race and comes fully equipped with mind, body, and emotions, then it follows that the individual is, in fact, a worshiper. It's factory installed, standard equipment, not a buyer's option. When you subtract the religious language, worship is the built-in human reflex to put your hope in something or someone and then chase after it. You hold something up and then give your life to pursuing it. If you live in this world, then sooner or later you grow some assumptions concerning what your life is all about, what you should really be going after. And when you begin to align your life with that pursuit, then whether you realize it or not, you are worshiping. We identify things we want, both good and bad, and then we make sacrifices to get them. That's the end of the quote. Now, we do not worship physical little idols like wooden or silver figurines, but we still fashion idols with our own hands that fit our current culture. We are still making for ourselves idols, and we are still worshiping at their altars, and this idolatry is the basis for the breaking of every other commandment. One idol that all people have made for themselves, and the idol all people worship before God, or more accurately, instead of God, is the idol of me. Will I be the ruler of my life, the captain of my ship, and the master of my destiny? Will I decide what I will do, how, when, and why I will do it? Or will I submit all that I am, all that I do, all that I think to the Lordship of Jesus Christ? Before Joshua led the Israelites into the Promised Land, he gave the Israelites several choices of gods to follow and told them to choose for themselves among them. The choices were, 1, the gods of Abraham's ancestors. He called it the gods beyond the river. 2, the gods of the Egyptians. 3, the gods of the Canaanites, the gods of the land they were about to enter. Or 4, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We are faced with the same choices today. Let's see how these choices that Joshua presented apply to our culture today. The first is the gods of Abraham's ancestors beyond the river. What does that mean in today's world? It means the gods our parents worshipped. I'm talking about the idols our parents worshipped. Examples would include a successful career, and the sacrifices on the altar would be time that should or could have been spent with a spouse and children. Another sacrifice on the altar might be some ethical choices made along the way. Another example of an idol would be a perfect home with all the newest appliances and the current fashion of furniture in the appropriate colors du jour. In such a home, your mother felt proud to open her home to all her friends and neighbors and hoped that theirs were not quite so nice. The second choice was the God of the Egyptians. Since the Israelites had been delivered out of Egypt and were about to enter into the Promised Land, this means the gods they had left behind. The translation for today's world is the gods of your past. An example of the genesis of these idols would be insecurities that you acquired in your childhood. For example, feeling that your older sibling was the real achiever in the family, and so you spent your life at home trying to earn your parents' praise, respect, or love. So the idol would be success in the world's eyes, or achievement, or even love, which can also be an idol. The third choice was the gods of the Canaanites, the gods of the land that the Israelites were about to enter. In today's world, that would mean the gods of the current culture. What are those? Money? Security and wealth? Food? How is food an idol? It works in us by causing us to choose food for the body, when what we crave is food for the soul. Sex is another. Pornography is booming business. It is important to note that not one of these things is inherently evil. Hard work, keeping your house clean, money, food, sex, all these things are morally neutral. It is when they control your life that they have become idols. And it is then that you have dethroned God and violated the first and second commandments. Even service to God himself can become an idol. Take the story of Mary and Martha. What Martha was doing was good and necessary. But Jesus said Mary had chosen better. Joshua's final choice was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That one needs no translation into today's environment. He is still the eternal creator of the universe, sovereign over all the nations and all individual men from the beginning. He is the only God whose service does not enslave, but frees. He is the only God who keeps every promise. He is the only God who fulfills us, the only God who desires to heal us, not to destroy us. Returning to Joshua, he, Joshua, then said, "Choose this day whom you will serve." And we must do the same. Each day we must consciously choose the God we will worship and serve. Will we serve at the altar of the idol of me? Or will we worship and serve the great I am? Will we pick up our cross, deny ourselves, and follow him? The idol of me is the one false god that every human being since the fall of Adam, except Jesus Christ, has worshipped. Even after we commit ourselves to following Christ, we will have to struggle on an ongoing, everyday basis to take captive our thoughts and bind them so they cannot gain control and rule over us. As we have already seen, there are many other false gods that we worship today in addition to the ubiquitous and very powerful idol of me. Unfortunately, those gods don't always manifest themselves plainly. Their control over the person who serves them is manifested in secondary symptoms. An example that was given in this book was of a person going to a stream and finding it full of garbage. The person cleans up all the trash in the stream and expects to come back the next day to a cleaned up, pristine area. But when he returns, there is even more garbage than before. So he hikes upstream to find the source of all this garbage, and he discovers that there is a garbage dump there. What we see in our lives is the garbage downstream, which are only the symptoms of the garbage dump that is upstream. The garbage dump upstream is the false god, the idol who has control over us because we have been worshiping and sacrificing at his altar. The only way to dethrone that idol is to go upstream to the garbage dump and deal with that. For example, if anxiety is a chronic problem for you, you could try all sorts of treatments, but that's just dealing with the garbage downstream. Addressing only the symptoms will not address the root cause. If you hike upstream, you will discover the idols of control and comfort. This is how it works. There are too many nasty surprises in life, terrible to contemplate, and you deal with that fear by trying to control every aspect of your life and perhaps the lives of those around you as well. You don't want anything to take you out of your comfort zone, so you meticulously monitor every detail of your life in an attempt to keep nasty surprises at bay. But God calls us to follow him outside our comfort zones. We have to recognize the idol we have made for ourselves and recognize the sacrifices we have made to that idol. What have we sacrificed on that altar? We may have sacrificed our own peace of mind, peace in our homes as we fretted and as we directed and as we worked ourselves frazzled, all with diminishing returns. Life keeps happening despite our best efforts. We can't control what other people do or what they think or what they are. But what we can do is choose to take that idol off its throne in our hearts and to destroy it, smash it to bits, and to enthrone there the Lord who really is in control of his creation and is sovereign over even what appear to us to be random acts of violence and chaos, because the Lord uses it all for our good and our growth in faith and for his ultimate glory. Another way of identifying the idols in your life comes from the story of Ahab, not Ahaz, but Ahab. You remember that he was a king of the northern kingdom, and since there were no godly kings in the northern kingdom, he was, by definition, a bad king. He was married to Jezebel, who was a vicious woman who killed many true prophets of God and took idolatry to new heights. The Lord sent Elijah to tell Ahab that he, the Lord, would withhold the rain for the next several years. Now we all know that a drought would cause a famine in the land, But there had been famines before and there would be famines again. Why did the Lord choose this particular form of judgment? The answer is that the primary false god the people were worshiping was Baal. Now, we think of him and his female counterpart, Ashtoreth, as fertility gods, and they were. But precisely because Israel and her neighbors were agricultural societies, their lives, their welfare, was tied up in the weather. And Baal was originally a god of the weather. The sexual component came secondarily. So the purpose of the Lord's withholding of rain was to show his own people that their false god, their weather idol, had no control over anything, much less the weather. Only he is the Lord of the weather and of everything else as well. In other words, the Lord withheld his blessing in the very area of their idolatry because it was the most obvious way to get their attention. So what's the moral of this story? What's the application point for us? If there is a specific problem area in your life, it may be that there is a false idol there, and God will not compete with a false god. Don't expect him to bless that area of your life. In fact, you should expect that he has been withholding a blessing in that area because he's trying to get your attention. He wants you to see that you have an idol and you need to dethrone it and allow the Lord to take his rightful place there. If you want something so badly that it has become a god in your life, then you have no right to ask God to bless you as you pursue that idol. May we work daily or hourly if necessary to dethrone the idols of our lives. May we deny ourselves the God of me and take up our cross daily and follow Jesus, who is called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, Emmanuel, God with us. Our final hymn is one of my favorite Advent hymns. O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lonely exile here until the Son of God appear. O come, thou wisdom from on high, who orderest all things mightily, to us the path of knowledge show and teach us in her ways to go. O come, thou rod of Jesse, free thine own from Satan's tyranny. From depths of hell thy people save and give them victory over the grave. O come, thou dayspring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night and death's dark shadows put to flight. O come, thou key of David, come and open wide our heavenly home. Make safe the way that leads on high and close the path to misery. O come, great Lord of might, who to thy tribes on Sinai's height in ancient times once gave the law in cloud and majesty and awe. O come, thou root of Jesse's tree, and ensign of thy people be. Before thee rulers silent fall, all peoples on thy mercy call. O come, desire of nations, bind in one the hearts of all mankind. Bid thou our sad divisions cease, and be thyself our King of peace. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. Amen.